Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really digging into something complex. We're looking at how a major religious institution tries to, well, manage its own difficult past.
We are. We've got a detailed analysis of a presentation. It's often called a fireside, given by Dr. Keith Erickson.
And he's a big deal in this world. He's the Director of Historical Research and Outreach for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Exactly. And his job, as he puts it, is to present a sensible history for everybody, which is a very careful framing. He has a PhD and an MBA, so this is about scholarship, sure, but it's also very much about strategic communication.
So our mission today is to take his narrative on these really sensitive topics. We're talking Mountain Meadows Massacre, the Word of Wisdom, polygamy, the Book of Abraham, and see how it stacks up against the documented historical evidence.
We're looking for where it aligns, and maybe, you know, more importantly, where it seems to deviate.
And we have to start with the big one, the question that really kicks off so many faith crises. Why didn't I know this? Erickson tackles this head on, this claim that the church hides its history. And his defense is, it's pretty simple. He just says the church has never hidden history.
The argument is, if you didn't know a fact, it's because you didn't learn it. It wasn't that it was hidden from you.
Yes. He even used this anecdote about President Nelson learning the deep etymology of the name Israel late in life, as if to say, see, even prophets are always learning new things.
It's a clever philosophical defense, you have to admit. It shifts all the responsibility from the institution to the individual member for just not having learned the material yet.
But that defense just, it falls apart pretty quickly when you look at the timeline of when the church actually disclosed things.
It really does. That's where you hit these sharp historical facts.
This is the aha moment for so many people. We're not talking about minor details. These are core foundational facts that were, you know, intentionally suppressed or at least strategically left out for generations.
Well, take the 1832 First Vision account. This is Joseph Smith's own earliest written record of his founding experience. The church didn't publish it until 1970.
And what about Joseph Smith's polygamy, the sheer scale of it?
The fact that he married up to 40 women, that was only officially confirmed by the church in their own Gospel Topics essays in 2014. Before that, it was denied, minimized.
And the seer stone, the actual rock he used for translation. We didn't even get an official photograph of that thing until 2015. These are not small things that members just forgot to learn.
No. And it feels much less like an educational oversight and more like institutional damage control.
And you can't ignore the role of the gatekeepers in all this.
That's the crucial part. It wasn't just a failure to teach. For decades, there was a clear pattern of excommunicating highly educated scholars.
People like Michael Quinn.
Exactly. People who were publishing this very research, especially on things like post-manifesto polygamy. So if you actively discredit and expel the people telling the truth,
you keep those facts out of the approved curriculum. You make them taboo.
Which, to any normal person, feels a lot like hiding history by, well, by destroying the credibility of the source.
It's a really good point. You create this situation where you can later say it was never hidden because you made sure no one in good standing was allowed to teach it. Okay, let's unpack this theme with our first major topic.
Yeah.
The Mountain Meadows Massacre. What did Dr. Erickson actually tell the audience?
He starts by acknowledging it was a terrible thing, which of course it was, but then he immediately minimizes the scale. He says, and this is a quote, about 20 Latter-day Saints committed murder.
About 20?
Yes. And he's adamant that Brigham Young did not authorize it. He frames it as the action of rogue individuals who went against the decision of the local Cedar City State Council.
So its position is just a few bad apples committing a crime, something that could happen in any church.
Right. But that number, about 20, that's the first major red flag in our sources.
It seems incredibly low.
It's extremely misleading. Historical estimates, and these are based on multiple scholarly accounts, put the number of armed Mormon militiamen who were directly involved at between 50 and 60.
50 to 60, that's a huge difference.
It is, and that's on top of the 30 or 40 Native Americans that the militia manipulated into joining the final attack. So we're talking about a group of almost 100. With an organized core of over 50 church members.
And these weren't just random guys from the settlement.
No, not at all. The perpetrators included the stake president, multiple local bishops. This was an organized action by local leadership. And then look at the institutional follow-up.
With John Dealey.
Right. The only person ever executed for the massacre. Years later, he was essentially given a posthumous church pardon, and his temple ceilings were restored, which begs the question, if the crime was so terrible, why restore his highest eternal blessings?
It really undermines the idea that the institution saw it as just this horrible rogue action.
And it also requires us to completely ignore the environment that made it possible. Erickson just glosses over the context of the Utah Reformation of 1856-57.
And that's the whole backdrop to this.
It is the essential context. Brigham Young was preaching this incredibly violent, high-stakes rhetoric from the pulpit. The key doctrine in play was blood atonement.
This idea that some sins are so bad that your own blood has to be shed to atone for them.
A terrifying concept. And it wasn't just rhetoric, it was policy. During that period, the very first temple recommend question was, have you committed murder by shedding innocent blood or consenting thereto?
Wow.
And you also had the oath of vengeance in the temple endowment, an oath to avenge the blood of Joseph Smith. And who were the victims of the massacre? Immigrants from Arkansas, the state where a key figure in Joseph's death was from.
So Brigham Young may not have sent a telegram saying, go do this. In fact, his telegram arrived too late saying not to. But by teaching blood atonement, by stoking this intense environment of vengeance.
He created the climate. He built the ideological framework that made the massacre not just possible, but in the minds of the perpetrators, justifiable. You can't separate the two.
It makes that rogue individual's claim sound.
Yeah.
Yeah, incredibly hollow.
It does.
This pattern seems to continue when we look at something like the Word of Wisdom, the health code.
Mm-hmm.
Erickson's explanation was that it was just difficult to implement because the members were addicted.
Right. So the church had to enforce it slowly by teaching it to the rising generation, you know, missionaries in 1918, and then making it a requirement for everyone else in the 1920s.
But again, it's what he leaves out that's so telling.
The omission is the whole story. He blames the rank and file members for their addictions without ever mentioning that the early prophets themselves were the main ones not following it.
The historical records on this are, I mean, they're pretty ironic given how strict the standard is today.
Oh, they are. Joseph Smith, who received the revelation, regularly had tea, coffee, wine. He smoked a pipe. There are accounts of him drinking wine in Carthage jail just before he died.
And Brigham Young.
Brigham Young told the saints to carry brandy or wine for medicinal purposes. He smoked tobacco himself and wrote about trying to quit.
So the very leaders who got the revelation didn't treat it as the binding commandment it is today.
Not at all. And they didn't have to. The original text in the Doctrine and Covenants, section 89, specifically says it's given not by way of commandment. It was advice.
Until Heber J. Grant.
Exactly. It only became a strict temple recommend requirement around 1921 under President Grant. So Erickson's narrative is just, it's misleading. He makes it about member weakness when it was actually about leadership practice and evolving policy.
Okay, let's shift to probably the most sensitive topic of all, polygamy. Erickson starts with the denials. How did Joseph and Hiram Smith publicly deny practicing plural marriage when they secretly were?
His defense is that they were carefully worded denials. The idea is they were only denying John C. Bennett's scandalous, unauthorized version of spiritual wifery, which involved promiscuity and abortion. So they were being technically honest.
That's a classic apologetic. It's not a lie if it's technically true from a certain point of view.
But the historical record just doesn't support that narrow reading. Joseph Smith himself, in a sermon, just flat out denied it. He said, "What a thing it is for a man to be accused of having seven wives when I can only find one."
That's not a nuanced denial of a specific practice. That's a denial of the whole thing.
It's a flat denial. And the institutional commitment to that denial was huge. The Doctrine and Covenants, their own scripture, had a section from 1835 all the way to 1876 that explicitly forbade polygamy.
So it was in their canon for the whole world to see.
While the leaders were practicing it in secret. And, of course, the ultimate act of denial was destroying the printing press of the Nauvoo Expositor.
Because it was going to expose the secret.
Exactly. An act which led directly to Joseph Smith's death. It's just, it's very hard to frame decades of institutional deception as carefully worded honesty.
Okay, what about the purpose of polygamy? Erickson directly confronts the idea that it was required for exaltation.
He calls it a folktale. He says it wasn't for procreation and that a modern apostle, Elder Cook, has confirmed it served its purpose.
So he's downgrading it from essential doctrine to a kind of cultural myth.
He is, but that completely contradicts the scripture that introduced it. Doctrine and Covenants 132, verse 6, says that those who have this law revealed to them must obey it or they shall be damned.
That does not sound like a folktale.
Not at all. That is eternal, damnable doctrine. And it wasn't just in the scripture. For a century, nearly every prophet, Brigham Young, John Taylor, Joseph F. Smith, taught explicitly that rejecting polygamy would lead to damnation.
So when the prophets teach something for 100 years under penalty of damnation, that's not a folktale. That is the doctrine.
It's the definition of institutional doctrine. And this idea that it has served its purpose is also shaky.
Why is that?
Because eternal polygamy is still authorized. Current leaders, including the president and his first counselor, are sealed to more than one woman for eternity. They are eternal polygamists. If the doctrine was truly over, they could issue a new revelation ending the practice of plural sealings for eternity, but they haven't.
Let's get into the most difficult part of this. Polyandry. Joseph Smith being sealed to women who were already married to other living men. How does Erickson handle that?
He admits we don't have a full explanation. He speculates it might have been about horizontal sealing or creating dynastic connections, but he is very, very firm on one point. There were no sexual relations.
That no sex claim is the key defense, isn't it? It makes the practice seem purely spiritual.
It does, but his explanation of dynastic sealing is a bit of a red herring. That relates to the law of adoption, which was about sealing men to other more powerful men, and it doesn't explain sealing married women to himself, cutting their husbands out of the picture.
And what about the evidence for sexual relations?
Well, it directly contradicts his claim. Historians like Dan Vogel have compiled evidence suggesting sex occurred with at least 11 of the 14 polyandrous wives. You have stories like Sylvia Sessions, who claimed her child was Joseph's, which shows intimacy was happening, even if DNA later proved the child belonged to her legal husband. The admission itself is what's important.
But the most glaring omission is the coercion involved. He mentions one of the wives, Mary Elizabeth Rollins Leitner.
And he presents it as a simple case of her husband being a non-member, so she was sealed to Joseph for, you know, spiritual reasons. But he leaves out the most disturbing part of her own account.
The angel with the sword.
The angel with the drawn sword. She said Joseph told her that an angel had commanded him to take her as a wife, and if she refused, that angel would kill him.
That is extreme coercion.
It is. And on top of that, she was 8 months pregnant with her legal husband's child at the time Joseph sealed her to himself.
An 8 months pregnant woman being told the prophet's life is on the line. That is not a benign familial connection. That is coercive prophetic control.
Exactly. It completely contradicts the sanitized picture Erickson tries to paint.
Okay, let's quickly touch on the last one. The Book of Abraham. How does he defend that?
The strategy is consistent. Create ambiguity where the evidence is actually quite clear. He downplays the papyri fragments we have, saying, nobody ever tells us how many scrolls there were originally.
Implying there's a lost manuscript somewhere that would prove it's a real translation?
Precisely. He also dismisses the fact that the fragments we do have are just common Egyptian funerary texts as a non-shocker story. And he pushes the catalyst theory that the papyri just sort of sparked revelation in Joseph, that it wasn't a literal translation.
But we know that's not what Joseph and his scribes thought they were doing.
Not at all. We have the grammar and alphabet of the Egyptian language, the G.A.E.L. documents. They show a clear, systematic attempt to assign whole paragraphs of meaning to single Egyptian characters. They absolutely believed they were performing a literal translation.
And we know how many scrolls there were, don't we?
We do. Joseph Smith's own history and witnesses like Oliver Cowdery, they record two scrolls, the Book of Abraham and the Book of Joseph. This idea of missing boatloads of scrolls is just an excuse invented much later.
Plus, the book itself references the pictures, the facsimiles.
Yes, an Egyptologist confirmed back in 1912, and then again when the fragments reappeared in 1967, that those facsimiles are just standard Egyptian burial scenes. They have nothing to do with Abraham.
So his whole narrative is about injecting doubt-missing scrolls, a mysterious catalyst process to protect the book from what is really overwhelming evidence.
That's a perfect summary of the deep dive. Erickson's presentation consistently uses inaccurate numbers, red herrings, and most importantly, critical omissions. The angel with the sword, the damnable teachings on polygamy, the evidence of literal translation for the Book of Abraham, all to build this one specific narrative.
And that narrative is one where church leaders are shielded. They never engage in deception. They never make serious doctrine-altering mistakes.
The end goal seems to be compliance, not genuine understanding. He tells you, the listener, to make peace with it however you want, but he does that after withholding the very tools you would need to actually analyze it critically.
He's removing the facts you need to make a truly informed decision.
We just hope this has given you a more complete picture of the history that's sitting just under the surface of that official narrative.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for you to think about. If church leaders did, in fact, mislead the general membership for 50 to 150 years on doctrines that they claimed had eternal, damnable consequences, what is the real principle guiding the church today? Is it ongoing divine revelation? Or is it persistent public relations pressure that forces change over time?
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.